For her, survival meant a hot bath, a great book, probably get some, something, something on the side, get a little high, and deal her in.
Hey y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson, and from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. Conversations with people from all walks of life about how the South shapes who they are and what they do. The obituary for Renee Corin was not your normal newspaper obit. One of the first sentences went like this: "The bawdy, fertile, red-headed matriarch of a sprawling Jewish Mexican redneck American family has kicked it." It went on to describe Renee Corin's life as a card shark, pothead, reader of trashy novels, and prolific spender of every dollar that passed through her hands. That obit went viral. It was written by her son, Andy Corin, a writer in New York City. And he has now expanded it into a memoir of his mother called Dirtbag Queen, which focuses on their life in Fayetteville, North Carolina, before moving on to his mother's final days among her squabbling family in El Paso. It is a book of love and chaos and frequent profanity. Those of you with delicate ears should know that all of that spills over into my talk with Andy. But I think you'll find that despite the chaos, the love part is what comes through the most. Here's our conversation. I started to say you and your family's life should be a movie, but what it really should be is like a 10-part Lifetime miniseries.
Lifetime. I mean, yes, that is.
Is that the correct network? Is that the
I
right?
Think so. With Renee, it's got to be. It's definitely got to be somewhat in the trashy corner. So Lifetime, I had this like fantasy that I would do like a two-part Fox, two-part like, or three-part even, event movies like Lace and Hollywood Wives, which is obviously in the book. That was my, dream. It's like, why don't we just do like a sudsy, soapy, like old school 1980s two-parter on Fox?
Well, the way that leads me to the question, I know you have worked in the entertainment business
yes.
a long time.
Well,
surely you have cast the roles in this drama by now.
Enough time has passed since I burned the boats and left show business. First I wrote her obituary, then I had to write mine, and I left. Really had to leave kind of that a lot of that thinking behind as much as I could in order to embrace the craft of writing a novel. I had, relatively speaking, a short, steep climb. And so, fortunately, since I was writing about real people, I didn't have to cast them. A lot of people, I think, of course, understandably, if you're writing fiction especially, it doesn't hurt at all. I didn't have to do that. I just thought of Renee, twin, asshole, rabbi, bonus. You know what I mean? I had to really just transcribe what they had to say. But in the aftermath, I have been gotten asked that quite a few times. There's so few people like my mother, who's like so ballsy and sexy and bold and just doesn't give a fuck. It's like Lizzo, maybe? Like, you know what I mean? Like Lizzo could play my mom.
You mentioned just in passing there the family names of your family members, all of whom have these incredible nicknames. Do you just want to kind of quickly tell people who's in this book, like the sort of the core group?
One of the reasons I adhered so strictly to their nicknames and mine, Jew Boy, first of all, that's just fun and fun to follow along as a reader. I love that shit when I'm reading a book. And I also think time and place, South, 1970s, it just made sense. There's Jew Boy, me, twin, who's my, not twin, he's my older brother by 15 months, but got held back a year. And so we ended up in the same homeroom for really like 7 years. So everybody just assumed we were twins. And so that was terrible. 8 years, actually, I think, 8 years. So that was weird. And then Asshole, who is still known as Asshole, and he lives in Powell's Point, or Currituck, sorry, not the Outer Banks. So he lives in Currytuck, and he's still I mean, it's on his garage, you know? So, and he is an asshole, and he's a lovable asshole, but he is an asshole. Rabbi, because he really was the only real Jew amongst us. And Bonus, who I always called Bonus to my mom. And so, because I didn't really, because and I used to say it snarkily, because he was the Bonus brother, you know, I used to say it. But in the journey of not only this book, but his and my own reconnection and our relationship now, it's such a loving moniker. You know, he is my Bonus brother. I've gotten a bonus check in terms of siblings, and it's just so precious. Oh, and Kathy Sue, I can't leave Kathy Sue out. Now, Kathy Sue, because she's dead, I just give her name. And I don't want to use her nicknames, but because trust me, she had nicknames. But you don't want to speak ill of the dead. Kathy Sue was a tough customer, okay? Everybody who knew her from Virginia Beach, Fayetteville to Virginia Beach to the Outer Banks, if you ran across Kathy Sue, you would not forget her. She was, you know, felonious to the bone. And so, you know, I call her the one-eyed pirate queen of Nag's Head Cove, but she had other nicknames.
This book started out as an obituary that you wrote for your mom when she died in 2021. And I'm wondering, first of all, were you planning to do that? And secondly, once you did it, or maybe as you were doing it, how did all these crazy family members feel about it?
To give you a kind of historical perspective, I've always been the Wednesday Addams in my family. So they view pretty much everything I do with extreme suspicion and resignation. There is no question that either my mom, you know, has just been lying my whole life, and there is somebody else out there who is my father, or something happened. I got dropped on my head. I'm not exactly sure, but we couldn't be more different in many ways if we tried. So they're fine with it because it's just one more crazy fucking thing Andy Corin is doing. They've always been super laid back about that stuff and generally supportive, but not like in a way that no gifts or cards or telegrams or showing up, but generally speaking, not litigious. So there, that's
Had you been planning to write that for a while, or did it just sort of happen after she died?
You mean the obituary?
Yeah.
So what happened was is the woman just wouldn't die. She couldn't be killed. It felt like we were literally constantly like playing whack-a-mole with her deathbed scene. And so we would get summoned down to El Paso. My brother, Rabbi, would be like, "You got to get down here right now." You know, we'd get on planes. I'd get there and she'd be like joking with nurses, throw the covers back, put on her slippers. We're going through an Arby's drive-through. She goes home. That happened th 3 times, and so to the point where you're just like, this woman is never dying. And so each one of those trips home, you know, I'm the scribe in the family. I've always been the scribe. I've always been the one asked to testify, whether it's at a funeral or 90th birthday for a grandparent, that kind of stuff. So I knew that I was going to have to bash out an obituary for Renee. But you know, if you read obituaries, they're really just awful. You know, they're just like, they look like typing lessons. They don't look like somebody's life. Those are people's lives, you know, and beloved, off to the Lord, you know, all that stuff. They just look so dreary. And you know, that's just not Renee. That's not how she lived. That is not how she died. So I knew that it was going to be her. It was going to have her DNA. What I didn't know is how long it was going to be. Because if I had known, I wouldn't have done that. Because I am just a broke ass writer. And when you go to print a 1,092 word obituary and you get that bill, you are shocked. And I was shocked. And I printed it in 4 newspapers. I had to pay for 3 of those.
Yeah, it's expensive now.
It was insanely expensive. I just want to make sure everybody knows I basically paid to self-publish a short story. So I was shocked. It was like $1,400. And we couldn't do the regular funeral situation because of COVID. Getting people together, getting people on a plane, getting people from all over, at that time was really complex. And frankly, my family is just shitty at planning things. And I've read about that in the book, where we like walk downstairs an hour after she's dead and we're like, so should we go to a steakhouse? You know what I mean? Like, there's just no, and they're all looking at me like I've planned some grand buffet down the street, and I'm haven't because my mother just died. I could barely get it together to make sure she had a good death and have this. For me, anyway, it was really important for her to have a solid passing, and I worked really hard to make sure that happened over the 4 days that we were in El Paso. But it's really hard when you're raised the way we were raised to do just to do some of these things successfully, because the trauma kind of response is to just run to the next thing, run to the next thing, or hide. And so that's why the obituary went out. When I got back to New York after she died, I was like, F it. And I sent it out. I actually thought they wouldn't print it. I was like, there's no way this is going to get printed. It's too spicy. And so I get a fact checker call from this nice lady at Gannett. And I was like, hi, I think it's Elizabeth. I was like, hey, Elizabeth, are you calling to tell me that you're spiking my mother's obituary? And she goes, well, there's a couple of things we need to fact check.
Well, I can see that because there are so many things in this book that I went, oh, come on. That can't possibly be true. But then, I look and you, yeah.
It's all true.
And so I want to get into the setting and the basis for all of this, which is your house or houses in Fayetteville and your mother.
Sure.
So most of this book is set in Fayetteville as you were growing up, with what you describe as this Jewish redneck family,
Yeah.
with the matriarch being your mom, Renee, who sold bongs out of the trunk of her car
And roach clips,
and roach
feathered
clips,
roach
sorry about
clips,
that,
and weed.
weed, and ran late night gambling at the bowling alley,
Oh, yeah.
and gleefully apparently spent every dime she ever made. And
Died completely broke.
why was she that way, do you think?
Well, that you're starting with the easy questions, I see.
Yeah, of course.
Part of the journey of this book is a journey of acceptance. The biggest is to accept, the biggest gift you can give is forgiveness. Of course, we know this. We're told it all the time. For me, I really did have to first and foremost enter into this writing process with a sense of gratitude and forgiveness, and just accept that she was what she was, all id, barreling through life, reacting, not planning, taking and grabbing. I think a lot of it has to do, of course, with her own parents, one of whom was garrulous and fun and a gambler and podgy and popular, and her father, her beloved father, who she really kind of wanted to be like. And the other, who we call Marion the Hungarian. Marion was really cold and withholding and kind of emotionally illiterate, and loathed my mother, loathed her looseness, her fleshiness, her loudness, her fatness, her brightness, loathed her, poverty, her filth, loathed her filthy sense of humor, and was really quite harsh with her in front of us. And Marion was like friendless, didn't drive. Her whole life revolved around her husband, who died unfortunately when I was a young kid. I was 8 or 9 when Fat Sam died. One of the stories that I had to take out of the book was me trying to figure out what you just asked. And I think it's because she kind of ruined their life with a scam she got them involved in. And it's stuff that I'm not really legally allowed to talk about, but got them involved in a real estate scam in the early 60s, and they lost this building that they owned, this apartment building that they lived in, one of the units, and rented out the other 7 units, a really nice one in Miami Beach. And they lost it because this grifter that my mother introduced to her parents basically conned them out of $80,000. And I don't think they ever forgave her for that, because they were forced to substantially reduce their lives and their lifestyles. And that all happens more or less kind of concurrently as her marriage is sort of unraveling and the Vietnam War is happening and poverty is really starting to nip at her heels and her parents can no longer take care of her. His parents, who used to be kind of reliably taking care of both of them, are falling out with him. It's really kind of a rough economic kind of snowball. If you ask me, from about 1969 or 70, she's really just in survival mode. For her, survival meant a hot bath, a great book, probably get some, something on the side, get a little high, and deal her in.
And for you and your brothers and sister, what you describe in the various places you lived is this sort of like rotating cast of people. They were always like sleeping on the couch or staying there all night playing cards or whatever.
She was incredibly generous. She was so
Well, I
generous.
was going to say there's like this line between generous and like absolute chaos. And
It was chaos, yeah.
I'm wondering when you were growing up, which one did you feel like it was?
I would have liked some privacy. I would have liked to live in a house that had less of of course, of a chaotic and, environment. I would have enjoyed having a parent on site, obviously, more, but the economics just were not, it just didn't allow for any of what I just, offered up. It was like some people were probably paying her, a little rent money to stay there for a couple of weeks or whatever, which she could use for like, shoes for us. You know what I mean? She was always hustling for a dime. Of course, I would have enjoyed having more stability. I shouldn't say envy, but I used to observe people with two parents. We had these neighbors. I won't say their real names, but they were so beautiful. They were like blonde and blue-eyed. It was a daughter and a son, a father and a, mother. And they would always have me over for lunch because they could see I was just starving. They would have like little plastic packages of like lunch meat, which it just seems like the most wealthy, rich person thing that I could ever have imagined is like these tiny little packages of like lunch meat. Because we're buying like hunks of like bologna that we would like carve off of, or stuff like that, government cheese, quite literally, because we're shopping at the PX on base. And so the commissary is where we got all of our food. We couldn't go to regular grocery stores.
Well, you got all of your food and bought some of it. And then the rest just sounds like there were some backdoor grocery shopping there.
We stole a lot of food. Oh yeah. Stealing food is a kind of a hallmark of my. Wish I could say it ended in childhood, but I went into show business where they pay you nothing in the beginning, like peanuts. And I used to have to get my boss. This would be in 1994, and this guy was freaking rich. He could have afforded to give me a free lunch. I used to have to get his lunch every day from this like really nice Chinese restaurant downstairs, and I love Chinese food so much. And I'm like literally living off of ramen or Snickers bars. And I would always like take like three or four pieces of whatever, off of his plate. Stealing food, I am pro stealing food if you are poor. Everybody should have access to food. I don't like people going to bed hungry. I think it is just appalling. It's so immoral.
It strikes me that this book, in some ways, is like kind of like this sociological look at what poverty's like, and part of it being that, and I know Renee's personality plays a part in all this, but also when you're constantly hustling and you can't see out far enough to make a plan, everything's about how do I get fed today or how do I make a dollar today or.
Yeah, live to fight another day was not, it's like it's stitched on my soul. That has to be unlearned. That you those stitches have to be pulled out. Survival mode is what I had been in for most of my life. It wasn't until I really, really, started listening to therapists that I stopped surviving and started planning for the future.
When we come back, Andy Corin talks about how he and his mother connected through the trashy novels they both loved.
The truth is that story was our love language. It's the first gift that a parent can give to their child, if you ask me.
That and more ahead on Southbound. Before we get back to this episode, I wanted to ask for a little help with something. If you enjoy Southbound, please give us a good rating and write us a review on Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast provider you have that allows such things. The more reviews and better ratings we get, the better chance there is that other listeners can find us. But to be honest, I'd just as soon you tell people about Southbound through good old word of mouth. If you could recommend it to just one person you know, somebody you might think would enjoy interesting conversations about the South, I'd be deeply grateful. If you have any thoughts about the show, guests to recommend, or anything that you think might make Southbound better, you can email me at ttomlinson@wfae.org. Thanks so much for giving us a little bit of your time. And now, back to my conversation with Andy Corin. This book is sort of like the living embodiment of that saying, I could talk bad about my mama, but don't you dare talk bad about my mama.
Don't you dare right. say a word about my mama.
Well, I will. Yeah, so I'm wondering, though, obviously, there are a lot of people who loved her, as evidenced by all the friends she had and stuff. But at the time, as you were growing up, were you aware that there were maybe people who didn't like what she was doing or weren't fond of her or were worried about how she was raising her kids?
If that was the case, she either kept it from me or I didn't see it. But I did just have pizza with Doreen, my mother's dearest friend at the Bolognelli, who worked in the Groove Bar when they met. And it changed Doreen's life forever. Doreen and I met up in Southern Pines, and I said, Doreen, I don't think I knew we were squatters until you really fixed me square about our situation at Three Colonies. So we had this house between Pamela Drive and Roach House, a townhouse situation, and it was nice. I thought we had finally made it. I thought the Corins we were George Jefferson moving on up. And it was like we had a swimming pool, clubhouse, tennis courts. It was a gated community. I could not believe my mother had pulled this off. She hadn't. I don't want to laugh too much because it'll make me cough. She basically borrowed it from friends she met at the bowling alley and a Tuesday night league. We were only supposed to be there for a couple of weeks. They felt bad for Renee because we had been evicted. They were like, no, you can stay. That house is for sale. You can stay there. And I always knew there was something a little weird about that house because we were constantly getting the power shut off, constantly. And I was like, this place is so cursed. You know, why can't she keep the power on? You know, it was because the owners were having the power shut off to get us out of there. So we were there for 11 months or so before we were finally evicted. Forcibly, I presume. I don't really remember the details. My brothers, it's all like cloudy for them. They're in like, you know, asking them to like recall anything from that era is like asking, you know, a drunk to leave a bar. I mean, it ain't happening. But Doreen was the one that was like, no, I don't think you were supposed to be there that long. And I was like, oh, we were squatters. You could just say it. We were squatters. We were squatters in Fayetteville. So I'm sure those people didn't care for Renee very much.
But there were, and you write about sort of the difficulties of living with her and stuff, but there were also some perks. I have to say, the kid in me just was filled with joy when you wrote that scene about basically her letting you have the run of the bowling alley.
Oh, yeah.
Like and getting the keys to the vending machines.
That was joy to write. I mean, that was pure joy to write. I'm glad it came across because think like imagine obviously how freaking cool to be able to run wild and have the keys to all of the machines, all of the snack machines, rolls of quarters in an arcade, basically. Because back then, you know, the bowling alleys were really just like an arcade with bowling lanes. Those were some really, really, really fun nights with my brothers.
And you have these really nice quiet moments in the book, too, where you and your mom are just kind of laying around on her waterbed, reading Judith Krantz or Jackie Collins or that sort of thing. I mean, do you feel like that was like the genesis of you as a writer?
Yes.
Kind of reading those books with your mom?
I certainly would not be a writer today if it wasn't for Jackie Collins and Judith Krantz, Howard Bast, Stephen King.
I love the, you know, like Nicholas Sparks with Krantz and Pants. Oh my God.
I wish I could have kept the whole, you make brutal edits, but I had a whole wonderful, because I read her the new Nicholas Krantz on her deathbed. Of course, I was like, I'm going to go get the new Nicholas Krantz and read it to you. The truth is that story was our love language. It's the first gift that a parent can give to their child, if you ask me. A fatherless, middle-aged homosexual. But sharing the gift of reading, this is not an admonishment, this is just a fact, really stirs something in a child's imagination that can last for the rest of their lives. I was a voracious reader because of her. And yes, I read what she read. So a lot of it was just like, swine filth. But I do think those kind of Horatio Alger, up from your bootstraps stories, they imbued in me a feeling of ambition, and I was a striver, and I just wanted to, I just wanted to get out of there, you know what I mean? And get on with my life. And now, of course, I'm like, what the hell was I in such a hurry for?
My mom worked, blue collar jobs all her life. The last 18 years of her working life, she was a waitress at a Denny's.
That is hard work.
But that's very hard work. The connection to you and your book is, I was always stunned at how beautiful my mom's hands were.
Yes.
After all that work. And you write lovingly many times over about your mom's hands. How did she keep them in such good shape with the life she led?
Her vanity, a kind of like maniacal commitment to those, hands, especially hands, face, hair. It was just kind of like we would starve before she would let either of those go. Now, she did do a lot on her own that she could do on her own. Shit had to pay out alimony to her until she died. That was the deal. It wasn't a lot by the end because he sued her multiple times to get it reduced. And, he was always dragging her to court to get it reduced because the deal was he had to pay her until she got remarried. That's how it worked. Finally, a judge was like, lady, this is insane. You've been divorced for 40 years. This guy should not be paying you alimony anymore. So he reduced it to $100 a month. To the day she died, that $100 a month was her manicure money. And she, because I used to be like, why are you taking money from him still? It's embarrassing. It's just like, it's so beneath you. And she would always say the same thing. She would wave her nails at me and she'd say, because they did all the work.
So you mentioned earlier on, talking about your siblings, there's this brother Bonus.
That's right.
Who was oldest brother who is not really part of the family for the longest time. And it feels like,
yes,
part of what you're trying to do in the book is reckon with how your mom dealt with them and how the rest of the siblings dealt with them.
I had to reckon with it in real time because I showed up while my mother was dying and my oldest brother and his wife, who I had never met, were on their way. It occurred to me even before he got there, like, why are we estranged? This is insane. It made no sense. I'm a grown man. Why do I dislike this person or being around this? It doesn't make any sense. There's nothing has ever transpired between us to cause that. It's just this inherited trauma that's been passed down. The matriarchy that raised me, my mother, my sister, my grandmother, were not fans of my older brother. That stems from his misplacement at a very early age. And his misplacement is a result of a misdiagnosis where he was, back then they called it mentally retarded. He wasn't mentally retarded. He was totally fine. He was a normal boy. He probably had some hyperactivity, some OCD, maybe some Asperger's. I don't know. But that misplacement marked him as a kind of, back then, that's how it was. You were an outsider. And so this shunning, this bridge burning, begins before I'm even born. So I have to deal with this estrangement of this person who I've only been really in the room with when we've had a pretty awkward couple of Thanksgivings where he's shown up and then been blown off by my family. And the death of my sister and the 90th birthday of my grandfather. And each time it was always it was just awkward. There was no affection. My mother was, it was very strained. I had to figure out why all that happened. And I do think a lot of it is she regretted it, probably to her dying day, wanted to do better or fix it. They did make up and they did bury this wound. They did have a much better relationship.
I think sometimes in these chaotic families, the siblings sort of unite, either in like support of or against the parent or whatever. But you guys, all of you, sort of fought each other all the way for years and years and years, right? There would be alliances and breakdowns. It seems like at one
We
point,
were not a close bunch. We were brawlers. It was my sister who ended up always being kind of the like way station to, filter information. And then she died. So we really, as brothers, had to figure out a new way to deal with each other. And we did eventually, slowly. Her death, like a lot of families, brings on, it's so stressful. It's stressful economically, it's stress, financially, it's just devastating. It's of course stressful emotionally. It's stressful like physically on my brother and his wife and kid. That was a lot to ask them to go through. And I wasn't there. I get it. And so my brother Rabbi really resented me. In the end though, what ends up happening by some sort of amazing, if you ask me, miracle, we were united briefly. It isn't perfect right now. A couple of my brothers are fighting. But I wish they weren't. But
Yeah,
wishes are
I was wondering how everybody's doing these
we
days.
were doing so great. We were doing so great. It was going too good. Twin and asshole are fighting. So.
Yeah, it struck me that one thing that happened right at the end was that somehow you guys like recreated your childhoods,
Yes.
in that this hospital room sort of became like the old living room of your house where everybody's yelling at each other
Right.
and people are coming in and out and it's chaotic and all. I
Glad you picked
mean,
up on that because I was trying to like pick some without it being too obvious, but I was trying to pick some of those chords. I wanted that to be the living room on Family Drive for her. I wanted that in real life when she was dying. I wanted her to hear us. When you are passing away, the last thing to go is your sense of hearing. And I wanted her to hear us laughing and fighting and eating and, making jokes. And, I wanted her to hear us. I wanted it to be loud and raucous in that hospital room.
last thing, as you mentioned earlier on, Renee was broke,
Yeah.
died broke. You did not have a large cash inheritance, but what did you inherit from your mom?
The list is long. So, resilience is an overrated virtue because it can be such a default setting. I have learned to be more vulnerable and to ask for help. I'm still not great at it, but her resilience is so, I'm so in awe of. I couldn't have done what she'd done, carrying all those kids through all that mess of the 70s and 80s. Her amazing sense of humor is my sense of humor. I won't be able to laugh now without gagging because of this cold, but her laugh is my laugh. Two of my brothers and I, we have her laugh. It's really amazing. We have her laugh. Her incredible, insatiable curiosity. Is that a gift or a curse? I don't know, but I have it. Whatever that was that I read this once, life wants life. That was Renee. Renee was life. She only wanted life. And I have that in my curiosity as well. Life wants life. Those are just a few things. I would also say her sweet tooth.
If you look at it a certain way, strip the humor out of it, Renee Corin would qualify as an unfit mother. She didn't plan or save for her kids, and often didn't make sure they were fed. She scrambled from house to house just ahead of the rent payment. She got high and stayed out all night and ran the occasional scam. There were times, reading Andy Korn's book and listening to him talk about his mother, that I didn't like her much. But I came away with two other things. One is the tremendous weight of poverty. The kind of poverty that forces you to think about nothing but the next day, the next bill, the next meal. It's hard in those moments to make much of a plan for anything. But the other thing I came away with is the power of forgiveness. To be able to look back at that childhood and not just laugh about it, but to see it with real fondness, takes a big open heart. Andy Korn and his brothers, too, got that from their mom, along with some awesome nicknames. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our editors are Eli Portillo and Jen Lang. Our main theme music comes from Joshua Lee Turner. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, the NPR app, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. Subscribe for free to get each new episode sent to you when it's ready. You can also find Southbound on our website. Just go to wfae.org/podcast/southbound. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.